last dance. We've come to the last dance. They're dimming the lights down. They're hoping we'll go. It's obvious.
It is the last dance, and welcome to it. I'm Scott Gregory, the producer and editor of the Museum Confidential podcast. This is the final show in our 10th season, and moreover, the final show in the Museum Confidential podcast series. On behalf of the host of this program, Jeff Martin, as well as myself, I want to say thank you very much to everyone who listened to this podcast and told others about it and wrote to us about it and invited us to come and present at your museum. Because of this podcast, we've been able to talk to many amazing guests and travel all over the country doing live shows, Museum Confidential live onstage presentations from Massachusetts to New Orleans to Hawaii and everywhere in between. It's been a remarkable run, and thank you again to everyone who checked out this podcast over that 10-season run. On this final episode, we hearken back to our first ever episode. Back then, our guest on that very first show was Scott Stulen, the then director of Philbrook Museum of Art. Today, our guest is the current Philbrook director, Megan Whitaker Nesbitt. And so, one more time from Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, this is Museum Confidential. Also, please exit through the gift shop. Thanks.
What do you think is going to be, looking back on this first 100 years of Villa Philbrook, the thing that could endure the most into the next 100 years? Is it just the physical space, the historic home, the collection? You know, what's the thing that, if you had to hang your hat on one piece of the experience, that you think has the most legs?
You know, I do think that the home is probably the thing that will resonate the most for the longest for the most amount of people. There's something when you just see, I saw on Instagram this weekend some wedding photos, right, from just a couple I don't know. And it was magical to just see people's connection to just the space. You can't replicate the physical space, no matter how hard you might try, and we don't want to try, right? So I do think that that is probably the thing that is truest to Philbrook's nature and will last the longest. That being said, I think, you know, if you look back comprehensively at 100 years, the evolution of the place somehow is also part of its nature. From being a private home to becoming this art center, developing as a professional museum, and then becoming this community place for Tulsa, all of that is still true. Mm-hmm. Every moment of its history is still true and accurate. And, you know, it really is that kind of palimpsest of all of those things layered together are Philbrook. And it's hard to state simply what that is, but I feel like that's how people feel about this place. And personally for me, I hope that's the thing that resonates the most for people.
One of the things that I think about when I think about longstanding institutions that they have to grapple with oftentimes, and this is also true a lot for big markets too, is oftentimes the institution is respected, meaning people in the community might be like, I'm happy to have that here. I'm proud to have it here. I show it off to people on occasion when I have people here. The city leaders oftentimes use it in, you know, marketing and things like that. But it's not particularly beloved. And mm-hmm. the difference between kind of respected and beloved, you can be both, but we've kind of gotten to a point here where through a lot of work, we've hopefully kind of moved into that space. And it's about ownership and feeling of ownership. You want to talk about like how you feel the sentiment of the community has changed toward Philbrook?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I love about working here, I mean, working at any museum is really remarkable to go into a gallery space and just see people looking at art and enjoying it. But one of the things that I think is really unique to my experience being here at Philbrook is walking into the galleries or out in the gardens and seeing people enjoying each other in the space. And I don't think that is true of every institution. And I am really proud of being part of an institution that has created that kind of space, that you see people feel comfortable here, you see people talk to each other here. And I think that's unique, and I think that's why we have become so beloved, is because you don't make memories with an object, you make memories with people. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think that's the difference.
You just crossed your 9th anniversary at Philbrook, I believe. Mm-hmm. And you've been in your role now as kind of president and CEO for what, like a year and a half?
Just under a year.
Just under a year. Mm-hmm. Okay. Time flies, mm-hmm, or doesn't, mm-hmm. Whatever.
Or it's been really long for you.
Yeah. We'll talk about that off mic, I guess. But I think now we're kind of heading towards that year. What's been the biggest surprise? I mean, you've been here for a while. You've seen this job and, you know, and doing that. Has there been anything that just was different, harder, easier, anything that was just different than your expectations for the job?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a couple really just work-based things that are interesting, which is I care more about this building than I do my home.
The physical building.
The physical building. If it is, you know, tornado season, if I'm in my closet at the house sheltering in place, I am looking at the map of what is happening at the museum, because the endurance of this place is important to me, to the community, but also it's the thing I worry about constantly. You know, we're in a 100-year-old building that requires a lot of care and maintenance. We're in a place that has a lot of severe weather in seasons, and that is very surprising to me, honestly. I didn't realize how much thinking about the physical building would take up my time. That has been surprising.
Yeah, you and I had an experience not long ago where we were at an evening event that was canceled due to a literal on-the-ground tornado, and we ended up having to shelter with a bunch of strangers for several hours, you know, and they were sitting in a room together on their phones. I think we were showing movies for the kids that were here. And those moments become kind of weird, and they kind of not quite magical because they're kind of freaky, but you can kind of create moments of memory even in those weird times.
I think the other thing that I'm surprised by in a really like pleasant way is how much, you know, I feel a great responsibility in managing this team, but I feel a very genuine care for my team, that I, you know, I want them to be happy here. I want them to be able to grow here. And I've always felt that, I think, as a manager, and when I could have control, but knowing that I have the responsibility of steering the course of this place, like I feel a lot more both responsibility and genuine, like, I mean, I would use the word tenderness for my staff, that I have been surprised by how much more I feel that in this role than even my previous roles.
You know, even in the past year, we've had some opportunities where you've gotten to flex some curatorial muscles as well, and you know, involved with installations and a couple of exhibitions in ways that sometimes directors of museums aren't. Do you view that as a kind of natural extension of what you're doing? Does that give you something creatively that you still need in this job that if it was just administrative, you wouldn't you would miss?
Sure. I mean, I think it does. It's definitely, you know, scratches an itch that I have. I started out in a more curatorial role and then moved over into fundraising and external affairs through my career, and it's fun to be back doing some of that work. I will also say that I'm a strong believer that directors should try to stay out of too many projects, because you can slow things down. And I think that's been both a pro and con of my involvement in some projects where I've needed to be more involved, just because of changes in staffing or project partners or things like that. So while it's really fun.
Or if you just have a vision for a thing that you want to see through from concept to creation. You
know? Yeah. So I would love to continue doing that just sparingly.
Yeah. I mean, I think it also gives you a chance to kind of see how things are working from a different perspective, you know?
I think that's really a
get in meetings accurate. You might not be in and kind of understand how those workflows are
absolutely.
Doing.
Absolutely, and make mistakes, right? Like I think just some simple things with ordering signage and being like, oh yeah, I totally approved the language, but I didn't check the size and I should have checked the size. Like very simple things that you can see, you know, firsthand how simple, like how much work people need to put into what they are doing and appreciate the skill and the effort that they're putting in. It's not simple, and it gives you a better appreciation sometimes for that.
you know, when a president is inaugurated, there's famously like the first 100 days mm-hmm. where they try to do a lot of things very quickly. Was there one thing or even a couple of things that you did when you officially took on this role that you feel like were symbolically you in the sense of like making an effort to put your stamp on this new administration?
Sure. Yeah, I think really putting a lot more focus for both our staff and our board on our collection, what we are actively working to acquire for our collection. We have this fantastic boon from creating this art fund from the sale of a deaccessioned piece a few years ago. And we have...
I'll direct people to refer to the episode on the $14 million vase. You can look that up in the archives.
Absolutely. You know, so for a museum our size, that's wild to have that kind of purchasing power. And with a strong market and a somewhat soft art market, like we have, this is a great moment for us to be really pursuing some things. And so I think I told, we had an auction that we went to 2 months ago, I mean, very recently, where we proposed to our collections committee essentially allowing a limit on a total amount for a grouping of works that would give us kind of the flexibility to go get some things that we really wanted that would help us fill a gap in our collection in kind of mid-century American modernism. Mm. And it worked fantastically. We didn't get everything we want, certainly, because that's never going to happen, but we got some really great pieces. We were able to add an abstract expressionist work by Mary Abbott, who is a fantastic painter, underrecognized, a wonderful addition to our collection. And then we purchased several other pieces, including a Robert Morris felt piece. And my specialty is in minimalism and contemporary art. I was so excited when this came out on the market. It is not a piece that you would see often. It's such a fantastic fit, I feel like, for our collection. And it's an area of art that we have almost nothing. Mm. We really don't have much. And for weeks afterward, I would turn to my husband and be like, hey, remember how Philbrook Museum now has a Robert Morris piece? And for me, that is some of the most exciting things that we can be working on as a museum, is building this collection that if we are really active and smart right now, in 50 years, we can have mm-hmm. one of the strongest American collections. I mean, not even American, just strongest collections in the country because of the smart buying that we're doing right now.
Yeah, I mean, being 100 years into the institution, you know, and gosh, 80 some odd years into the actually being a functioning museum, having probably the best opportunity in the history of the organization to actually grow the collection from within without having to depend on bequests and things like that. Yep. So how do you balance between your personal taste and what you think the audience wants to see, and like trusting your taste to know that, hey, if we get this, pursue this, you like it. Mm-hmm. How do you know the audience will respond? Or is it more about teaching the audience, you know, kind of using that opportunity to kind of take them further than maybe they are willing to go?
Yeah, it's really a balance. I mean, certainly there are many things that come up for auction that we talk about on the curatorial side of the institution that we are like, oh, isn't this beautiful? And we know it's not going to be the right fit for us. Either we don't have the right other artwork to properly contextualize it. It's not an area of focus for us. We have a collecting policy and a collecting plan. So that's step one, right, is like have a plan that you're building toward. So we have that. We work with the curatorial team, the whole team, to talk through this is, you know, these are a few works that we're interested in. What are people's thoughts, opinions? And then we go to the collections committee for approval on the ongoing for those pieces. Not every piece we want to go for is going to be a winner with the committee either. So we need to do enough work beforehand that when we're presenting it, we're saying, you know, this isn't the right price point for us. This is the right time period that we're trying to fill. This adds, diversity to the collection in terms of artist representation. There's lots of reasons that you're going to want to go for something. So, and I mean, really, pacing is important too, you know. So if we find a piece we really love, if it's not the right time, saying this is an artist we want to add to our list and think about, you know, maybe we even want to commission it if it's a living artist. So I think it's just the fact of working in a collaborative institution, you're going to have compromise around those things. So even when someone feels very strongly about it, we go back and forth. We in fact went to auction last week for a piece that we did not get. It went far above our approved price point. But we were very excited about it, but we went back and forth for days about, is this the right fit for our collection, and pros and cons, and really discussed it. And even though it was a piece that myself and Rachel Keith, our deputy director of curatorial affairs, were in love with, we really battled if it was the right piece for us. And we decided at a certain price point that it would be, but that it wasn't like a piece we needed to go to the mats for, you know, like we really just wanted to add it if it was the right thing.
What was the first thing you ever did in a museum job was?
I was a curatorial assistant at my university museum. That was the very first thing, my first professional job. I worked in the director's office at the Museum of Contemporary Art San Diego.
So in those roles, did you have aspirations to be a museum director?
No, I had aspirations to be a curator.
Yeah.
That's where I thought I wanted to be. And I worked with a lot of curators in those roles and wasn't sure if that's... my passion is contemporary art, and working with living artists is both a pleasure and something that I was like, I don't know if I have the right personality for working with artists necessarily. I can be very like logistically minded, and sometimes that's mm-hmm. not going to be the best fit for, you know, a conversation mm-hmm. or working through a project. It might be a great place to start a conversation with an artist, but it's not necessarily like the person who should walk alongside the artist. And then also working in a director's office, I found that job, the administrative part of the job, pretty fascinating, honestly. And I really loved the relationship building aspects of like creating community partnerships, working with other organizations that I got to work with in that role. And I realized I had a real knack for that too. So that kind of had me start thinking about it, but it wasn't necessarily on my, this is my ultimate plan, until maybe, you know, the last 5 or 6 years. I was like, yeah, I think I want to do this.
So long, farewell, our readers, and good night.
I hate to go and leave this pretty sight.
This episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by the last day of the exhibition. You've done it. We've done it. Everyone has done it. You knew about the exhibition. You heard the ads. You got the emails. You told yourself you would go. But in spite of all of these signifiers, all these motivating factors, you waited until the last day of the exhibition to see it. Wow, it's really busy here, you think to yourself. There is, of course, a reason for this. You're here on the last day. You're not alone. Almost everyone waits until the last day of the exhibition before they finally go see it. According to a fake study that we just made up, 20% of all exhibition attendance takes place on that final day. At least it certainly feels that way, right? This ad paid for in part by the Society for Art-Loving Procrastinators.
You know, Philbrook's had many directors over the years. Not very many women directors, and I think you're the first one in over a quarter of a century. And I'm just curious, when you talk about some of these new collections, you're looking at some women who've been kind of left behind in the abstract expressionist space. You know, do you bring some of that into kind of the areas of interest, or is that totally, you know, not part of your curatorial interest, kind of highlighting women artists and things like that?
I think it is definitely part of my interest, and I don't know if it's always consciously part of my interest, but certainly I think that some of the artists and movements that speak to me personally are going to be, you know, women artists who are working. And I certainly do think one of the things that's fun, in my opinion, about, you know, curatorial projects and research is discovering the unknown. And often women artists, until very recently, were quite overlooked in creating the canon. And so that discovery element is kind of fun, too, to say, hey, this is someone we've really missed, and we should bring them to the forefront. And certainly, honestly, for our buying capacity, that's also a really smart move to make just market-wise, right? Is if we were buying an abstract expressionist work by Jackson Pollock versus Mary Abbott, those are very different things because of how canon has looked at them. Mm-hmm. And so Mary Abbott's going to be in our reach, whereas other artists are not. So there's kind of all of those things at play. Mm-hmm.
What's an ideal day for you at work?
You know, an ideal day is kind of what I have every day, which is I never know exactly what's going to happen in a day. And I love that.
Lots of meetings.
There are a lot of meetings.
Day, like every day you have several meetings on the calendar, right?
Yes. Okay. There are a lot of meetings. So I get up, you know, I'll go to bed at night, know what's on my calendar for the next day. But I 1,000% know that that is not what my day will look like because just something will happen. And sometimes it's something really exciting, like someone emailing me, which recently happened, and said, hey, you know, we'd love to sit down and talk about an art gift. Fantastic. Love that. Let's get on that right away.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's someone calling at, you know, 10 p.m. saying, hey, we just found a small leak in a hallway and we need to talk
triage,
about where that is.
Yeah.
So, and I work well with the unexpected, and I like that my day is never the same. And so,
and being kind of on call 24/7 doesn't bother you.
No, it doesn't.
And that's important, I think, to know that that's something you can.
It really is. And I didn't always know that about myself, but I really do like that energy. And for me, the reward is when you are, you know, on call 24/7, it often means you're here physically in the building. And when I'm here in the building, there's the opportunity to see people doing things that are making them happy. Like, it's very rewarding to walk into the museum and see happy people. I couldn't, you know, ask for a better payoff.
Yeah.
So if I'm here on a Friday night, it's probably because we have a film on the lawn and I'm walking down the ramp to the great lawn and seeing hundreds of people looking happy, listening to great music, and it really does fulfill you.
When it comes to kind of the dreaded concept of work-life balance, which is still a new concept for society, you know, me personally, I've always had a blurred line between work and personal life, and I, you know, I've been lucky enough to work in places that I feel passionate about enough to where I, you know, I don't see it as just a clock in, clock out kind of job.
Yeah.
But I do wonder, you know, you seem to be like very engaged with every aspect of it as well, but it was kind of an epiphany to me at some point, maybe in my late 30s or sometime, where I kind of realized I can't expect everyone to work like I do.
Yeah.
And there were times when I would get frustrated because I felt like I'm working this way and you're not. And, you know, and then I kind of found this space like, hey, everybody kind of does their thing and finds their balance. And, and you know, just as much as I don't want them to change how I work, you know, I have to find that same. Have you had similar thoughts over the years in terms of how you kind of, what you bring to the job versus what your expectations of everyone else are?
Yeah, I think I definitely have had similar realizations to what you described. And an awareness of, specifically now in this role, that I need to model some balance. And so being really thoughtful about when I send that message or that email or make that phone call, is it, does it need to happen right now? Or am I at least being very clear that this doesn't need a response until, you know, Monday or whatever that is? Because I am like always thinking about this job and what could be what we need, but also what could be really fun, what could be exciting and next. And that's the part that really feeds me and my energy.
Enthusiasm.
Yeah. Kind of. Yeah. And so, but I also realize that when I send someone, you know, wouldn't this be fun to do? Not everyone receives that the same way.
Well,
right?
And you being their boss,
there's
an obligation to respond that comes with that.
Yeah.
Whereas you might mean it like, hey, here's a fun idea. And they go, is this a new project I have to work on?
Exactly. Exactly. And when do I have to do it? And
Yeah.
So I have been, you know, really, I have been really mindful of that. And I think it's an important part of like building kind of your concentric circles of teams of like, these are the people that you can send that to, like at your, you know, senior leadership level, to say like, hey, we should think about this, and know that they're not going to immediately think we have to do this.
Yeah.
But I also think, you know, like you, finding other things that I'm passionate about that are not just work related, and really sharing that with other people, that your work might fulfill you, but it's not going to fulfill everything about you. And one of the things that is both the best and the most challenging about working in nonprofits is that people are incredibly passionate about their work. And sometimes I think they maybe even put too much into it, and it's really healthy for them to have other things that will help fulfill them, because a job's not gonna do everything for you, you know? And so, you know, the way that you have so many projects that you work on outside of work that you're passionate about, finding other ways to spend that energy that also fulfill me. So for me, it's dogs. I foster dogs. I get my little puppy high every few weeks by getting a new foster dog, and I put a lot of energy into that, and it's a good use of my energy that is separate from this place, and that's really important for me.
Yeah, no, that's important. You know, you mentioned that Robert Morris piece, and you mm-hmm. got so excited talking about it. I'm curious, you know, do you feel the same spark about art that you always have? Has it grown? Has it changed? You know, when you were a young, idealistic, wannabe curator,
yeah.
do you still feel that same verve that you always have for art?
You know, to be very transparent, it ebbs and flows.
Yeah.
So I think there are periods where if I'm really thick in the thick of it with, you know, fundraising or building a new building like we are right now, there are times when I'm not able to get the rest, what I might get out of it normally, because I'm just too full of other stress or things going on. But I also find it's really important for me. This place is fantastic, and it's also really important for me to go other places to see what other people are doing and have someone else have put together a thought or a curated project for me to enjoy. So that when I, you know, if I go out to art gallery, sometimes I can look at just a piece of art and really feel something from it, like our We Art piece. I can do that right now. But sometimes I go out and think about, oh, well, that wall, we need to still open that up and see what's happening with that light fixture. I get too lost in that. So going to other spaces here in town, traveling to see other art, like I can get it still. And there are pieces, that Robert Morris for me, like I look at that piece and I can't not feel excitement about what this means for Philbrook, what it means for the future of our collection, and also just like, this is a work that's really challenging, and I like that challenge of how do we share this with our audience and get them to love this piece as much as I personally do. That is almost as exciting to me as the artwork in itself, is that, you know, every piece presents a challenge of how do I get this to connect with someone else.
Yeah, I mean, and so much of the job is kind of cheerleader in chief, you know? Like, if you can really articulate and communicate why something is exciting and what it means and get people on board with it and always fight apathy and always fight any kind of malaise, you know, which is always rearing heads at different times, especially in times of great change or, you know, we have major projects happening and that can really get people mired. And so it's, and so, you know, morale becomes such a big piece of success. Is that something you think about all the time?
Yeah, it is. And I think that one of the biggest challenges, maybe there's two, is making time for me to think about what the message is so that I don't get so lost in the details, making sure I've clearly articulated for myself what the message is and then that I can share that with other people. And then second, making sure I have enough time for people, because I think one of the most important, I don't know how everyone else feels about it here, but I think one of the most important parts of my job is making sure I'm stopping by just occasionally, talking to people, not even like articulating a message, just being visible and making sure that people see me, which helps them know that I'm seeing them.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important part of the job.
So we're talking on the verge of Wine Experience, the largest fundraiser the museum puts on biannually. Biennially, one of those, look those up. But we have the Tandy Pavilion, which is a major new capital project, building opening in the gardens just in a few weeks. Rebranding the museum is happening imminently. These are some major initiatives. There's a capital campaign around the corner, all these different pieces. A lot of balls to kind of keep in the air. This is the 10th season of this podcast. 10 years from now, if you're still doing what you're doing, you know, what do you hope is kind of the legacy of your tenure 10 years from now? What will you have hoped to have achieved in a decade from now?
I think that we will have reached more of Tulsa, honestly. Like, there are much grander visions I have than that. Like, like us to reach far beyond Tulsa. I'd like us to be traveling our collection much more internationally. I'd like us to continue to acquire impressive works that build our collection. There's a lot of that, but I think the most important thing for me is reaching more of Tulsa. There's plenty of people who have still never been to the museum. There are plenty of people that you talk to that say, oh yeah, I went there, you know, in my third grade, class visit or whatever. We just had a group out to look at the new horticulture plantings out at the Tandy Pavilion. And while they were here, it's like, you need to come see this Andy Warhol show that we have up right now. Like, you just have to take 3 minutes before you leave and come look at this space. And I watched, you know, a group of adults go play with the silver cloud balloons in the space and smile and have this joyful moment. And almost every single one of them came out and said, yeah, I haven't been here since I was a kid. And every single one of them, I said, you know, do you have kids? And they said, yes. And I'm like, well, you got to come back and bring your kids. Like, this is something you do as a family. This is something you do with friends. It's not just a class field trip. You just have to keep coming back. And I promise every time you come, you're going to see something different that feels right and fun and makes you smile, makes you think. And that would be my, that would make me the most thrilled, is if we're seeing just more of Tulsa walk through these doors.
You have been listening to Museum Confidential. This podcast was a co-creation and co-production of Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa. The podcast ran for 10 seasons. This is the final show in our 10th and final season. Thank you again to everyone who checked out this podcast over the life of its existence. And this podcast was hosted by my friend Jeff Martin. I was the editor and producer, and my name is Scott Gregory. And please, if you can, always remember to look
closer.